Tuesday afternoon from 4:30 here on BBC Radio 3. If you'd like to be in the audience, apply for tickets by just going online and searching for Radio 3 in Tune.
And now Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the former SAS sergeant and thriller writer Andy McNab.
Andy McNab is rather lucky to be alive today. In fact, from the beginning, his life has been characterised by exceptional risk and danger. As a baby, he was found abandoned in a Harrods carrier bag on the steps of Guy's Hospital. By the time he was a teenager, he was in trouble with the police. Joining the army at 16, he served in the SAS, and in 1991, during the first Iraq war, he led a secret mission to infiltrate behind enemy lines. It was a disaster. He was captured and tortured savagely. Three of his fellow soldiers didn't survive. Andy McNab's account of his captivity and eventual escape, Bravo 2-0, became a worldwide bestseller and launched him on a career as a writer. Since then, there have been more than 30 thrillers, with sales totalling 32 million. So the baby who was left in a carrier bag is not just a survivor, he's an extremely wealthy man now. We were very keen, actually, Andy, for you to come on Private Passions, because at a literary festival recently, you were asked by one of your readers if anything made you cry. And your reply was really very surprising, because you clearly have made it through torture and capture and the death of friends without crying a great deal. But the one thing that does undo you and makes you cry is opera.
Yep, it's got me. It's got me. It's the story, it's the live performances, the emotion. And I don't know why it happened, it just did. It's amazing.
And especially in Wagner, where it's really full frontal, isn't it? You know what
totally.
I mean? It's absolutely in your face. And of course, this music has become very special to people who have been part of airborne forces. Famously, of course, Apocalypse Now.
And so much so that the British Army's Parachute Regiment in the 1980s adopted it as their official quick march, you know. And whether you're, you can be in the German airborne, the American, the British, Spanish, it doesn't matter. When that music is played, every airborne soldier gets it. Everybody feels incredibly proud. It's called the Airborne Brotherhood, and that's the music that binds it together. That's why music is so important within the military.
Thank you.
Can you imagine being an 18-year-old young airborne soldier? It doesn't matter what country you belong to, and you're in the airborne and you're on your passing out parade and that's playing. Fantastic. And so much so that certainly every funeral that I've been to of soldiers, this is always played, and in quite a few weddings as well, because it is so part of that airborne brotherhood.
The opening of the third act of Wagner's Die Walküre, the second opera of the Ring cycle, Pierre Boulez was conducting the Bayreuth Festival Orchestra. And actually, mention of Bayreuth reminds me that I think this is very much on your wish list, isn't it, to go there?
It certainly is, yes. I'm trying to get to Vienna this May and hoping to bring my wife along. I love it. My wife hates it. So the plan is in a day we can go and do, you know, coffee and croissant stuff, and in the evening I can go and see it. So we're trying to get that compromise at the moment.
Tell me how your love of classical music began. I think you were sort of 17, 18.
I was in an infantry battalion at the time, and it was all very macho. The war of choice at that time for the British Army was Northern Ireland. So we used to do about 4 or 5 month tours every year from the garrison town in Tidworth where we were. And so by now I'm sort of, you know, late 18s, nearly 19. I've already done a tour of Northern Ireland, so I'm in the platoon. I'm sort of, you know, dead hard. And there was this new guy who turned up, about the same age, who was what they call a PO, a potential officer. So he was, you know, clearly more educated. And this guy started playing this really weird music, and it was Genesis. Never even heard of Genesis. This is what sort of, you know, POs sort of play, not a clue, you know, because if it wasn't The Clash or Madness or any of that sort of music at the time, I had no idea this stuff existed. He played Los Endos, which was a Genesis instrumental track, and it just went on and on and on all night. And I thought, right, this must be the classical thing, because that's what it sounded like to me. But that was my introduction of, do you know what? There's other stuff out there. Yeah, in fact, that song cost me 6 points on the A303 coming from London to the West Country. Because the music gets so fast, you get totally engrossed in it. And on that stretch of dual carriageway, there seems to be a speed camera every mile. So I got 6 points in one day listening to that. So Phil Collins drumming, you know, he owes me a few bob. I'll take the points, but he can pay the fines.
Los Endos from the Genesis album, A Trick of the Tail, which was released in 1976. Andy McNabb, just before we move on to what difference the army made to your life, perhaps you could just tell us a little bit of about your childhood so we understand the difference.
Yes, I was adopted when I was five and basically lived in South East London, mainly in Peckham, South East 15, and just grew up on housing estates. Went to, I think it was 9 schools, because we used to move around, all in the same area really, but we used to move about quite a lot. And I thought I had a fantastic childhood because it was just let to do your own thing. It was fantastic, but obviously really counterproductive because one of the reasons I got into certainly juvenile detention was that I just wanted stuff without actually realising I've got to get an education and earn it. And that's one of the reasons why I got in the army. And it was then when I discovered the reason I was in the infantry as opposed to a helicopter pilot, I suppose, was that I had numeracy and literacy of below of an 11-year-old, which was the average for us junior soldiers at that stage anyway. That's why we were in the infantry. But I was really, really lucky to get an education in the military, and a tri-service education, something that the Ministry of Defence don't jump up and down enough about. It is a fantastic success story. Because it's got to take people like me and be able to, teach them to, not only take information in, but give information out. So I was very, very fortunate through the next sort of 18 years to get an education, because I just didn't bother when I was a kid. It was just playing about in housing estates, really, just doing your own thing.
And I think for you, aspects of the army were rather luxurious, which not everybody would say that.
No, it certainly is.
Showers and things.
It's almost sort of cliche stuff, but actually there was hot water, there was your own bed space, because I used to live in the front room, so wait for everybody else to go to bed and then sort of sleep on the settee. And to the point where certainly in the army, as a 16, nearly 17-year-old sort of young man, you're told to have 3 showers a day because you're running in the morning, you're getting muddy at lunchtime, and all of a sudden this regime of heating, hot water, and your own bed space. For me, it was amazing. I couldn't understand why a lot of people who were there for that initial 3 months didn't like it. I thought it was fantastic. And you got paid. It was a mutual contract.
The next music comes from your training period in the SS in Hereford, didn't it? And actually, I'm really intrigued by this because it's music that I think suffuses a kind of peace and meditation and incredibly beautiful, and it's at the root of a lot of Western music.
Yes, very much so.
Tell me how you encountered it.
Well, it got into Gregorian chant through the monks at Belmont Abbey, which is just outside of Hereford, and the Special Air Service has a relationship with them through a number of things, through rugby, and the monks like watching the rugby, and every year within the Special Air Service there's a big inter-squadron sort of competition. Through languages as well, certainly during the period of time where the Special Air Service were operating a lot in Africa, and myself included, we went to learn Swahili, and a lot of certainly the older monks had been missionaries in Africa and knew the language very well. And also through members of the Special Air Service getting married and converting to the Catholic faith because of it's the new sort of family that they're going to be involved with, and then going to those weddings. And the monks are great guys. You go, we've done 10 weeks with 2 of these monks from Belmont Abbey to learn Swahili. So they would come down at 9 o'clock. By 10:30, they would say, right, that's it. We're off to the pub. Because they're saying, look, we invented this stuff, So for them, it was a day out, and they got the habits on. And
of course, the monks, it just occurred to me, they also have quite a disciplined routine.
Very much so, very much so. I've been to a couple of their dinners where they have the silent dinners, which is really hard because you get in your head, right, this is what we've got to do. I'll go with a friend who's going through the conversion.
And you like to chat, then?
Yeah, and you go and you're having a chat away. And there'll be sort of different, there's different signs that you learn for butter, and all of a sudden you sort of, you take a breath and they sort of look at you because they know you're going to talk. And you go, I get it. No talking. And then when you see them down the pub, it's, you can't stop them talking.
Whoa.
Benedictine monks of Belmont Abbey singing Crux Fidelis, music my guest today, Andy McNab, heard when he was training for the SAS. As part of the SAS, you spent some years in Northern Ireland in a series of covert operations. I always think that must be almost more unnerving than when you're in straightforward combat, if you see what I mean.
Yes, no, it is. It is, because you've got no control. If you're in what we call a green option, so you're there, you've got your assault rifle, you're up to your chin in Kevlar body armour, all those sort of things, there's a feeling of control. because you can react. You can sort of, you know, literally go on the offensive and you can do something about it, whatever the situation is. The problem with certainly undercover operations where the primary task is always to gather the information because only then you can start taking action. It's a very passive role to
and
do.
And not knowing whether you might have been sussed out.
Well, that is the problem. I think certainly people like myself were picked for these. You know, you get asked if you want to go and do these jobs, but actually they're telling you you're going. And I lived in Derry for 2 years.
You were only about 19 when, in Northern Ireland, I think you first had the experience of killing somebody. And you've written about that experience. And presumably you must... I know you've killed a lot of people since, but that first one has always stuck in your mind, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. It has. And not in a sort of, a, you know, like a deer-stalking manner, it's the first kill. Certainly in during the conflict at that time, there was an incentive if you got a kill or what they called an A1 arrest, you know, one of the top 20 terrorists. In fact, there was 2 weeks extra leave at the end of the tour. So there was that sort of credibility in that way. But actually, as an individual, yeah, I didn't particularly like it. I thought, well, I don't want to do that again. But as a young man, I, you know, again, sort of all rough, tough, you know, sort of 19-year-old, what I didn't want to do was tell people I was scared. So I actually lied and said, yeah, you know, I just told them what they wanted to know. And it was only when I got into the Special Air Service, actually, where, you know, you'd be talking about these professional sort of special forces soldiers been doing it for, you know, 16, 17 years. You get involved in something. For me, it was Southeast Asia the first time working with the Special Air Service on operations. And we'd come back from jobs and these, you know, senior NCOs in the Special Air Service go, oh, I didn't like that. Don't want to do that one again. Because actually, what they discovered to be scared is normal. It's a really good thing to be because it focuses everything.
Presumably, being with guys who perhaps are not scared is pretty worrying.
Well, yeah. Well, there's the saying, look, you know, if you're not scared, you're a liar or there's something mentally deficient, so you shouldn't be doing the job anyway. Mm.
Talking of Northern Ireland, Andy McNab, that leads on to your next choice.
Well, it's Clannad and the theme from Harry's Game, which was a drama that came
about the Troubles. Yeah.
About the Troubles. It was about a guy who went in undercover into Belfast to try and sort of infiltrate the Provisional IRA based on a Gerald Seymour book. And Harry's Game was the theme to that TV show. And certainly as a young soldier, very much I wanted to watch that. And then when I started doing that sort of work myself, and certainly being in Northern Ireland, it sort of really resonated with me. Because
and they used an ancient text from Galway, I think.
Yeah, I have no idea what the words are on this. I haven't got a clue what they're saying, but it's just fantastic.
Well, what they're saying is, in war and violence, no side will win, all will lose.
Fall the door, fall the door, fall the door.
We heard the Irish group Clannad with the theme from Harry's Game, the song which launched their global career. Your own army career, Andy McNab, took you to Iraq in 1991, and a mission which has become famous through your best-selling account of it in Bravo 2-0. You write very vividly about the day-to-day hardships of your mission and being captured, imprisoned for 9 weeks, tortured. And I wonder what kept you going during that awful period of being held in the dark, in a tiny, filthy cell, beaten and interrogated constantly.
It was really certainly the interrogations were the more of the physical side, where, you know, there was three of us held in an interrogation centre in Baghdad. And, you know, all of us were whipped. We were burnt with spoons over paraffin heaters, because by then all the utilities had been bombed out. We were getting bombed every night. I had some teeth damage after I got caught and through getting rifle butts in my face. And my teeth were pulled out with pliers by a guy who said he was a dentist from Guy's Hospital for the last 9 years, has gone back to the war, and all the time handcuffed and blindfolded.
What do you think about the recent revelations of what the CIA do in order to get information? Does that surprise you? Do you think they're justified, or do we have to get real, or is it not good?
It doesn't surprise me. I think that post 9/11, the gloves were off. But even the VC French and the Gestapo quickly found out that long term interrogations didn't produce the intelligence that could be worked on. However, there is an argument for tactical questioning for short term interrogations, and basically, if you like, it's that field type interrogation where there's an immediate danger to life, and basically you just need to know where, when, what and how. And as an example, if, for instance, one of the 7/7 bombers were caught the night before the attacks at King's Cross, would there be an argument then, if they're not going to give up that information, to actually interrogate them physically to get that information? So it's the detriment of one for the safety of the others. But it's a very delicate line. But
would you say the means justifies the end in that instance?
Yes, it does. And I think that, you know, I've been asked many times about that. And if I was in that situation trying to get that information, I would physically interrogate them and know that there's a good chance I'll be prosecuted. However, I'll take my chances in front of a jury because I think I'll get away with it in that context. But long-term interrogations for decades have been proven not to work.
So what kept you going through that dark period?
The training that I got, it's almost some sort of cliche to say, but it's actually true. We have what's called R2I, resistance to interrogation training, where you go through some physical interrogation, so you understand, you know, the physical hardships of it. The most important part for me was the last week of the training, to listen to an American US Marine Corps Phantom pilot who was on board an aircraft carrier during the Vietnam War. He was on his 77th mission. He only had to fly 80 missions. That was the end of his tour. 77th mission. He's off and gets shot down and had 6 years in solitary confinement. And every major bone in his body was broken. Untold diseases. And this guy stood there. He was, you know, he's got no hair, no teeth, no muscle mass, but he was alive. And what he understood at the end of it was that he could do nothing to affect what was physically happening to him. If somebody wanted to come in and talk to him, well, they would do that. He couldn't resist that. So it was pointless. So all efforts were his integrity of his mind, keeping his mind together. And certainly I'd be sitting in the interrogation centre on week two, and I'm still alive. I know a guy had 6 years of this, and he survived. So therefore, it's all right at the moment. You know, if I'm there at 6 years' time, well, maybe I'll start worrying about it. But at the moment, so far, so good. It's all about the integrity of the mind. Don't worry about what they're doing physically.
From those very dark memories, we turn now, Andy, to some of the most joyful music ever written, Handel's Messiah. And I think you saw this in an opera production in 2009 at the EMA.
Yes. Yeah, yes, absolutely. My wife took me to see him and said, right, you've got to go and see this. Because, again, it was all sort of stirring music, and she knew it backwards, because it seems that every year they'd be playing it since she's about 8 years old at school. There'd be a performance. Yes, went to the English National, saw it, thought it was fantastic, loved every single minute of it. The reviews weren't that good, actually, but, you know, I didn't care. It's live. You know, it's just live music, people really, really going for it. And every Christmas now, we have between sort of 12 to 14 people every Christmas come to our house. And they get it every morning. They get handles and stuff, whether they like it or not. And certainly young kids are going, what is this? And say, shut up and listen. It's great.
And they that dwell, that dwell.
Sir Malcolm Sargent conducting the Huddersfield Choral Society and the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra in music from Handel's Messiah, a recording from 1959. The bass was James Milligan. And all the details of today's recordings are on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. Your ear for music has also been slightly your undoing, because I know that one of the things that most sort of haunts you about your experiences of captivity and torture is, curiously, the sounds of it.
Yes, because I was always blindfolded and handcuffed, all there was sounds. So it was trying to, you could use sounds for the time of day. There may be something, you know, whether you know there's a call for prayer or whether there be certain vehicle movements or people walking past the cell.
Keys jangling.
Keys jangling was a not a good one, because when you heard keys jangling, you thought, are they getting the key for my cell, which normally meant they were coming in to take you for an interrogation or come to beat you. So as those keys were jangling and they went past myself, well, that's good. Someone else is going to get it, but they, you know, they're suffering and they're thinking exactly the same.
And the bolt and the door.
And the bolts and the doors. And the doors were quite warped. These were steel sort of plate doors. So once the bolts were thrown, then the doors had to be kicked. So you had that almost like that garage door sort of metallic sort of rattling going on, which was never a good sign, because that was, you know, it meant that the guards were really sort of, you know, all revved up, and they're all aggressive as well. So they're coming in because, well, they're going to come in and start beating you. So all those noises all meant a different thing, certainly at different times of the day.
You regained your freedom, Andy McNab, as part of a prisoner exchange with Iraqi prisoners, and all of a sudden you were home. And I wonder what kind of adjustment was needed for that. You were back at work pretty soon.
Yes, the culture is very, an extreme military culture is the way to put it, if you're involved in special forces. You go straight into debriefs, it's straight, literally straight back into work.
And of course, you had a daughter, Kate, and I think you only saw her for about 12 weeks altogether in the first 2 years.
Yes, I did, yes. I was the trauma of that, certainly during capture, was saying, well, I haven't seen enough of her. That was quite upsetting.
And indeed, you had to write a letter, didn't you, to your daughter, just in case, I think.
Yes, yes, and that happens quite a lot. So basically, before you go on jobs, you write your letters, and that goes into a pack that stays back within the UK. So if there's a problem, the guys back on the rear party there can get the pack and do whatever they need to do with their letters. And always a letter, actually, which says, put £500 behind a squadron bar, because you have to pay for your party. If you're dead, you have to pay for it. So everybody comes and eats your curry and drinks your beer.
La Traviata next.
Yes, love it, love it.
And particularly with Maria Callas.
Yes, yes. And it's, you know, it's the only advantage I can think is if I was older, that they'd have been able to see her. And I love this. I went to Barcelona to see her for a long weekend there. Fantastic live performances, everybody going for it, and just a great story. And I really wish that it was one of the fortunate ones to see Callas singing it. Il giorno mio, sempre lieta.
Gabriele Santini conducting Maria Callas and Francesco Albanese as Violetta and Alfredo in Sempre Libera, the aria which closes Act One of Verdi's La Traviata with the RAI National Symphony Orchestra. I wonder, Andy McNab, if you're at all surprised by the way your life's turned out. I mean, your terrific success as a writer, for example.
Yes. I recognise my privilege, and I recognise where I am and how I've got there. And what I know is it was education. Now, it was being fortunate enough to being exposed to education. Actually, education rammed down my neck, whether I liked it or not initially when I was in the army. So what I do now is go back to schools, certainly go into prisons and to military training establishments, and explain sort of, you know, my life and getting into the army. It doesn't matter I got the education in the army. It doesn't matter. It was all about education, because what education gives you is power, the power to do the things you want to do. And all of a sudden, you know, do you want to write another book? Okay, try it again. And it's just gone on from strength to strength. So it's I have to do it for a living now, because I've signed on the dotted line.
You have had to keep your identity slightly under wraps, and there aren't photographs of you other than in silhouette, and this is not your real name. And that's rather appropriate, because there's an element of that in the last choice of music, which is Nessun Dorma, and the words of the aria are all about trying to guess the singer's real name and how he'll win his true love, because nobody can guess his real name. That's rather a nice coincidence.
It is. That is really, really good. I just love this piece. I've never seen it. I went to Lucca once on the off chance to try and see it. We were driving past and we heard it was on, but it was all sold out. I defy anybody who, you know, it doesn't matter if they don't even like music, regardless of opera, to listen to that and not get so sort of revved up that, I don't know, climb a mountain or, you know, swim a river or something, you know, to actually get the heart pumping. It's just an amazing piece of music.
Anyway, look, we don't know who you are, and I won't ask you any further, Andy McNab, but I do thank you for revealing what you have revealed of yourself, which is quite considerable, as it always is, through your love of music.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been great. Thank you.
Vincerò, vincerò. Andrea Bocelli singing Nessun Dorma from Puccini's Turandot, with Vladimir Fedosyev conducting the Moscow Radio Symphony Orchestra. And ending this week's edition of Private Passions, in which Michael Barclay's guest was Andy McNab. The producer was Elizabeth Burke for Loftus, and you can download a podcast of that programme and many others in the series from the BBC Radio 3 website. Next week at the same time, Michael's guest will be the choreographer Robert Cohen.
A great thinker.
The orchestra's a dead object.
A great composer.
The new technology, it will kill the music. That's absolutely a stupid way of thinking.
A great conductor.
I began to conduct to learn how to deal with instrumentation.
Pierre Boulez is 90. And next Saturday, BBC Radio 3 celebrates the birthday of possibly the most influential figure in post-war European music. At 12:15 on Music Matters, Boulez at the BBC. At 7:30, live in concert at the Barbican. Total immersion, Boulez at 90. And at 10 o'clock, Here and Now features Boulez's music with performances by the BBC Symphony Orchestra and the Guildhall New Music Ensemble. Boulez at 90,